And welcome. I'm Mark Winkworth. You're listening to Tales of the Sea. My guest today is an ocean policy specialist. He didn't start there. After college, Michael Conathan worked as a journalist, a children's book editor, and a Hollywood screenwriter. But the ocean has always had a hold on Michael, and now he's got over 15 years of experience working on making things happen on international, federal, and regional maritime initiatives. Lately, he's been focused on growing the sustainable blue economy. I'm pleased to welcome Michael Conathan, dad, surfer, and number one fan and supporter of his writer-comedian wife, and a senior policy fellow with the Ocean Foundation. Mike is also an independent consultant for a number of like-minded organizations, including the Environmental Defense Fund, the World Bank, and the Sustainable Ocean Alliance. Yep, all of that. He believes, obviously, in a well-rounded life and that collaboration is fundamental to durable solutions that can help to sustain our oceans. In other words, the blue economy. And without further ado, let me say welcome, Michael, to the program. You know, a lot of people might be familiar with the term green economy, but less so, certainly in my case, with blue economy. So can you share your definition of that term?
The way I look at it is, and there are a lot of definitions out there, but the way I look at the blue economy is to think of it as economic activity that either relies on or benefits from healthy oceans and coastal ecosystems.
Right.
I mean, there's so much that the ocean provides that we don't even think about. It's, you know, fisheries and coastal communities, but increasingly it's more emergent sectors that are related to technology, research and development, and just understanding what the ocean is, does, and provides. And of course, the biggest sector by participation is tourism. Coastal tourism and recreation, and nobody wants to go play in a dirty ocean. So Keeping the ocean healthy means, you know, major dividends to coastal communities and all the activities that depend on them.
This certainly applies to all countries around the globe. So is there, you know, some kind of general agreement as to how to approach issues related to the blue economy?
Well, when you talk about countries, you inevitably have to talk about political systems. The formal definition that I like comes from the World Bank, which has been working on these issues for a long time. They define it as the sustainable use of ocean resources for economic growth, improved livelihoods, and job creation while preserving the health of ocean ecosystems, which is a longer, wordier way of saying kind of what I said at the top. So some people define the blue economy as encompassing all economic activity that has to do with the ocean, which would include such things as global shipping, for example, which got 90% of the goods that we buy in this country come to this country on an ocean-going vessel. Is it part of the blue economy? I would say no. Other organizations will define the blue economy to include freshwater activities. So there's a lot of overlap between what happens in the ocean versus what happens in the Great Lakes or river systems or other things like that. So there are lots of definitions out there. And then you get to the questions of like, okay, well, which industries actually count? Like, does offshore renewable energy count as the blue economy? It's good for the planet, probably, for the most part. We need to do more of it to produce energy in less fossil fuel intensive ways. And it's something that's critical for the future of our climate. So that's important. But does it in any way benefit the ocean? Sure, tangentially, in the sense that less carbon in the atmosphere is better for the health of the ocean long term. But it's more of a tenuous connection than something really advancing technologies or practices that are going to help clean up the ocean. You know, taking plastic out of the ocean, is that part of the blue economy? I think it is.
What about aquaculture? I would think that would be another important component.
Aquaculture is actually a really interesting piece of the blue economy as people are learning to do it better, not just in finfish practices, but also in growing shellfish and seaweed. Oysters and kelp are a huge part of the growing blue economy here in Maine. And oysters and shellfish obviously are delicious. They're amazing, healthy food. They also are actually filter feeders, and so they end up cleaning the ocean as they grow. And that actually improves ocean health and makes water quality better as we're restoring some of these things that, that existed previously. Kelp is fascinating because you can make almost anything out of kelp. It seems like people are, you know, it's food, but it's also people are using it as a substitution for plastics. People are using it in biopharmaceuticals. People, you know, it's almost a, it's like a wonder plant of a kind. You know, you can do all incredible things with it. It grows really fast and it pulls carbon out of the atmosphere as it's doing it. So lots of these opportunities to create economic growth.
A quick side note. I read somewhere that if you feed cows kelp, if you mix kelp into their feed, you reduce the amount of methane that is expelled from the cow manure by some crazy percentage. Cow burps, I think they call them, a major contributor to climate change.
Full of methane, which is, of course, a greenhouse gas that's 10 times more potent than carbon. And so if you're pulling out 50 or 60% of the methane that a cow is producing, it's actually a pretty significant climate impact. And it really affects the carbon footprint of beef.
Yeah, seriously. Knowing that 71% of the Earth's surface is water and oceans make up 95% or more of that. So that's a huge area to cover. How from a policy perspective, you know, knowing what challenges you're going to tackle next, how do you and your colleagues sit down and say, okay, here's the focus for the next, you know, X months or years or what have you?
Yeah, it's a huge challenge, and it's made more challenging by the political subdivisions that exist within that space. So you've got, you know, here in the United States, we've got state waters that in most cases extend out to 3 miles from shore, federal waters where U.S. government has full control over activities for the most part goes out to 12 miles. And then we've got this exclusive economic zone that extends beyond that out to 200 nautical miles from shore, which feels like a lot. But then you get beyond that and you realize the fact that what that means is that still 2/3 of the ocean itself is actually beyond any national jurisdiction. And so it's incredibly difficult to manage. Right. And then there are all the different activities that take place within it. And how much are we managing for the benefit of human populations? And how much are we managing for the benefit of the biodiversity that exists in the ocean? And then you can't really regulate it because who really controls it? You know, we as humans have spent a significant amount of our time focusing on what happens on land because it's the space where we can exist and live.
Mike, the majority of your work today is as a private consultant, correct?
Now all of my work is as an independent consultant. So the Ocean Foundation is one organization that I have been doing some projects with related to blue economy and ocean clusters. I'm also doing some work with the Environmental Defense Fund, EDF. Doing some work on aquaculture development and specifically how we create a framework in the United States to manage aquaculture in federal waters. I've been working until recently with an organization called Sustainable Ocean Alliance, which is about providing young entrepreneurs and future ocean policy leaders with opportunities to plug into the network of policy leaders around the world. So working at a global level. So how do we put the ocean more at the forefront of people's thinking so that we understand what it does and figure out how to take care of it better.
Right. That certainly makes sense.
So we just don't understand how these systems function. And so when we're trying to solve a problem like climate change on this grand global scale, and we look at the ocean as a huge factor in that because it absorbs so much of the carbon that's been emitted and it affects the entirety of our climate and our weather patterns by the way it circulates heat around the globe. We just don't understand why that is. And so before we can do anything, we've really got to get to the root of these degrees of understanding of what the ocean is doing and what it provides.
Mm-hmm. Mike, what other issues come to mind when it comes to understanding the complex marine environment?
One of the issues that I've been really digging into lately, in addition to aquaculture, is this issue of deep seabed mining, which is kind of a fascinating one for a lot of reasons. It touches on a lot of different things. So there are areas of the ocean where typically the remote and deep ocean, particularly one called the Clarion-Clipperton Zone, which is sort of in the central Pacific. And there are these great abyssal plains that are, you know, 3 to 5 kilometers below the surface, 3 to 5 miles below the surface of the ocean. the bottom, the seabed there, is littered with what look like cobblestones, but they're just, they're nodules. They're basically rocks about the size of a potato for the most part. And they have they've accreted minerals over millions of years. And many of these minerals are now things that are coming into greater demand for some of our modern projects, everything from national defense to batteries that we need to fuel an electrification revolution mm-hmm. as we're trying to decarbonize.
For your writers out there, this sounds like the beginning of a great sci-fi movie.
And so the issue becomes, if we can figure out how to harvest these things in a relatively seemingly unintrusive way, you should be able to then provide a lot of access to these minerals that are critical for all of these different needs. The problem is we don't understand how those ecosystems work. You can go down there and try to scoop up these rocks, but you have to get them with these big tractor-like machines, and they stir up plumes of sediment into areas of the ocean that are typically undisturbed. And so when you dump a bunch of sediment into the water column...
Well, that sounds dicey.
We don't know what effect that has on the species. We don't even know what species live down there. So we don't know how to manage it. Further complicated by the fact that it does exist on the high seas beyond any national jurisdiction. So now you've got to come up with an international management framework to figure out who gets to go get these things.
Yeah, that sounds like a sticky one, and one that I bet that you enjoy getting deep into the weeds on. Mike, let me ask you, where did you grow up, and what are your earliest memories of the sea?
So I grew up on Cape Cod. I was a full-timer. I remember as a kid, I learned to sail. We had a couple of small boats. We had an old knock-around Boston Whaler, and we had a Beetle Cat, a wooden single-sail sloop size. It's sort of like a bathtub, really beamy and slow. But we used to race those as kids. So I grew up on and around the water. And I remember, you know, being out with my dad. We would go out in the fall, especially, and pick up bay scallops and oysters and such. We weren't a big fishing family, but we got out on the water a lot. You know, just sort of in my veins. I mean, as kids, we would take field trips to the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution from, you know, elementary school. Arguably the world's greatest research institution, kind of, you know, half an hour from my front door. And so it was just something that was kind of part of my life. I ended up going to college. I was effectively a major in undecided. I ended up being an English major because I'd taken more English classes than anything else. Not because it was, you know, this great passion for me, but I went to Georgetown University in DC. I thought, there's no way in hell I'm ever going to be one of these crazy political policy people. Like, I didn't like any of them. That was not at all what I was interested in. But I did spend a semester while I was there. There was a program that Williams College runs at the Mystic Seaport Museum in Connecticut. And it's a semester-long program, and we had about 20 to 22 kids, like 18 to 22 kids per semester. It was a maritime studies program, interdisciplinary. There was an oceanography class, literature of the sea, maritime history, which obviously is the bread and butter of Mystic Seaport Museum. And there was this marine policy class, which was part of the curriculum. It really caught my attention. I was really interested in it as somebody who, you know, loved the ocean, grew up around the ocean, but just I don't have a science brain. Like, I can't do that level of, you know, detailed math and the things that were going to be required to become a scientist. But that marine policy class kind of stuck with me. And, you know, after I graduated, I went off and did other things that you're supposed to do with an English degree. Supposed to. I had a stint working as a journalist. I worked in journalism, actually as a photojournalist for a year or two up in New Hampshire. And then I went and worked in publishing, and I edited children's books and young adult novels in New York for a few years. Then I ended up moving to Los Angeles and working as a television screenwriter, because that's a thing you do, apparently.
Oh, sure. Everybody leaves college and goes to Hollywood, where they land a plum job on network television.
At that point, I'm about 8 years, 9 years out of college. I've got a girlfriend who I love, who's successful in the screenwriting and acting and stand-up comedy world. I've got to figure out what I'm going to do next. So eventually I talked her out of staying in LA and got her back to New York. And then I ended up in grad school for marine policy, going back to that class that I took as an undergrad at Mystic Seaport. The professor of that class ran head of the Marine Affairs Department at the University of Rhode Island, and I got back in touch with him, a guy named Dennis Nixon, and he said, sure, come on down and apply. And they let me in, and I got a master's in Marine Affairs. So that's been my career ever since.
And of all things, you come all the way back around to marine policy. which is very cool. But then you land in D.C. working for one of Maine's better known senators.
I had a choice between a couple of different offices. One was a senator from Oregon who was willing to take a fellow, but didn't really have a seat on the relevant committees. And the other was a committee staff job working for the Republicans on the Senate Commerce Committee as a subcommittee. At the time was called Oceans, Atmosphere, Fisheries, and Coast Guard. And the chair of that subcommittee was Olympia Snowe, who was obviously a longtime senator from Maine, moderate Republican, and with a great reputation of working on ocean issues.
Well, that seems like the perfect fit for a guy with salt water in his blood.
Worked out amazingly well. I mean, Olympia was still a mentor and a role model, you know, one of the hardest working people I've ever come in contact with, just an incredible powerhouse of a woman, and my colleagues there were great. And, you know, I think we got a fair amount done on the committee.
A quick side note here, Olympia Snowe is a well-respected and revered figure from the state of Maine with a distinguished 40-plus year career in politics. She was the co-chair of the Senate Subcommittee on Oceans, Atmosphere, Fisheries, and Coast Guard, and introduced bipartisan legislation to create a national endowment for the oceans, coasts, and Great Lakes in order to protect and preserve natural resources for future generations. Mike, at one point you decided to leave Washington. Was that to pursue other interests, or had you had enough of the whole scene?
You know, we went through a couple of cycles of Congresses, and, you know, we're sort of introducing the same bills and not really making any progress, and things were becoming increasingly polarized. This was 2006 to 2011. So the end of the George W. Bush presidency and the beginning of the Obama presidency. The majority changed hands a couple of times. I was in the minority. I was in the majority. But, you know, it seemed like things were getting a little more entrenched, and some of the more Republican extremism in opposition to things like spending money on research programs, particularly anything related to climate change, which you were not allowed to say in a Republican office those days. Back many Republican offices back in those days, Olympia was not one. She was always actually very, very progressive on climate. And it just felt like things were really entrenched and polarized. And I wasn't enjoying the kind of treadmill of introduce the same bills, have the same fights every 2 years, and not seeing a lot of progress. And it got pretty frustrating. So I was looking for another opportunity. And so I ended up finding a job in 2011. This is where I kind of jump across the aisle. So the Center for American Progress is a fairly progressive DC think tank founded by John Podesta, who had been Bill Clinton's chief of staff and obviously went on to run Hillary Clinton's campaign, and has been a senior advisor to Democratic presidents from Obama right on through to Biden now. And so he also was a big climate advocate and an ocean advocate. Mm-hmm. And Center for American Progress was looking for somebody to set up an ocean policy program at CAP, as the acronym goes. And I applied and ultimately got the job. And so decided to shift gears, come off the Hill, go work for CAP and start to focus. And that's really where the blue economy work started to launch. You know, if you think back to 2011, you know, we're still coming out of the recession and the housing crisis. Everything in politics was about jobs, and job creation, and how are you going to build jobs? So really, if you were going to make any headway, what I learned on the Hill was that it had to be about economic numbers, and it had to be about how many jobs is this project going to create for my constituents. And so, stepping away from the Hill and into that policy advisory role, as you have in a think tank, it was really about doing the research to make the case for strong policies. And I was trying to balance, or I guess I was trying to use the economy as a means to create better environmental policy around the ocean. Mm-hmm. So by emphasizing the jobs and the economic activity that could be created by healthy oceans and coasts, and moving away from jobs and economic activity created by things like offshore oil and gas and other harmful aquaculture practices or other negative components of ocean economies, it could be a lever and a pivot point. I did a big project on the Pebble Mine project, which was a proposed mine in the Alaska wilderness that was going to threaten, you know, one of the world's greatest salmon resources for a short-term gain of, not insignificant, but for mineral resources in an open pit mine, where you would then have to, you know, store tailings and toxic mine waste in perpetuity in the Alaska wilderness.
Yeah.
So, you know, not a real good idea. So we pushed back on that and did a lot of work with the Obama administration as well around establishing marine national monuments and creating areas that could be sort of permanently protected from industrial activity.
Right, right. I totally hear what you say. I mean, it seems as relevant today as back in 2006 that you're pushing this big rock up the hill and not making any progress, and people are getting more and more entrenched.
You know, when John Podesta went over to the White House, he went to the White House to work for President Obama towards the end of the second term, and he said to me, you know, President Obama really likes designating monuments. You know, he's done real well with some of the monuments that he's designated. It's a great tool that the president has. We have an opportunity to do more of this in the ocean space. But So I was able to work with a couple of other colleagues of mine, former NOAA administrator and some other folks. And we put together an organization that basically it was a coalition of all of the ocean NGOs. And we sort of evaluated all the proposals for marine monuments and which ones seemed like they were going to be the most effective, the most impactful, and the most politically feasible.
That's another quick side note here. The definition of creating monuments, that's another way of saying preserving federal lands, which would include the sea, that have historic or scientific interest.
And ultimately brought those forward through the Obama administration. We got major expansions of big monuments in the Pacific around some of the island territories, setting those areas off limits to industrial activity. And a first one in waters of the continental United States, here off New England, Northeast Canyons and Seamounts, Marine National Monument. Relatively small area, but really important underwater resources of underwater mountains and canyons that are just teeming with all kinds of life from the surface to the seabed.
Mike, I can't help but think you must have felt a real satisfaction in the work that you did during those years.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's really, it's what we're losing in our political spectrum right now, across the board, where there's this insistence now that if I don't get everything I want from my side, then nobody's going to get anything. Mm. And I'm not at all, I'm not a both sideser when it comes to politics, reality is we are a country, we're a nation with an incredibly diverse populace that all wants different things. And we cannot simply be represented by two individuals or two parties. There has to be very large scale coming together of people to talk about ideas. My work really is about finding compromise. It's about finding those positions where, okay, I recognize what you're saying. I understand that your perspective has some value. I may disagree with it. But when it comes to our environment and when it comes to the future of the planet that we all live on, we have to recognize that there's going to be a balance between using resources and protecting resources.
Mm-hmm.
So you look at something like the monument that we established.
And that would be the Northeast Canyons and Seamounts Marine National Monument off the New England coast.
We listened to the concerns of the fishing industry, and we created some changes to the monument as it was originally proposed to accommodate some of the legitimate concerns of the fishing industry, to allow them space to operate in between the different components of the monument, to provide an extended period of time before the fishing regulations would take effect so that they could adapt their business models. There were concessions that were made in creating that process. They didn't like it at the end of the day.
Yeah.
They'll still say they weren't listened to, but the reality is we did adapt it and we made it a little better.
Mike, I remember you telling me that with the change in administrations, the vested parties were more entrenched than ever. And then at some point, you decided to move on from CAP, the Center for American Progress, to work on other ways to approach policy.
And so that led me to again start the job search, and I ended up landing at an organization called the Aspen Institute. And what I liked about Aspen was that it really does do this. It brings people together from across the political spectrum. It is a truly nonpartisan organization. It was a space where we could host some of these conversations, where we would have Republicans and Democrats, conservatives and progressives sitting around the same table. And it's incredibly gratifying and encouraging work, bringing together bipartisan groups of legislators to have conversations about big thorny issues facing the country and what we should do about them and how we can potentially find some opportunities to work together. We went to Iceland with, I think it was 22 members of Congress, no staff, just the members of Congress and their spouses for 4 days with some of the world's most prominent energy security experts for a conversation about energy security, and blue economy was part of that. I was the rapporteur. I'm not putting myself in the category of world's most prominent expert, but I was just thrilled to be in that room. We had it was 15 Democrats and seven Republicans. And yes, they were a self-selecting group. You know, we didn't have the extremists from either party, but we had a really thoughtful 3.5 days of incredibly insightful conversation. All the legislators were incredibly collegial with each other. They got along well. They had disagreements that were respectful. They had agreements on more things than I could have possibly believed going into that conversation. And honestly, it left me with a much deeper understanding of the fact that despite the screaming fits that happen in the media, most people that we have working for us in Congress are actually really thoughtful. They're really engaged, and they are willing to work together to solve problems.
Mm-hmm. And those would hopefully include the challenges of the blue economy. Mike, I'd like to ask you, if you had to pick the key issues you think that are facing all of us, particularly those who are involved day to day, to ensure the health of the oceans and to understand and to put the correct policies in place to ensure that there is a long-lasting, sustainable health, what would those top issues be? And part B of the question is, where do you see progress that you find personally encouraging?
It's a tricky question. We've got to deal with climate change, and we've got to resolve the carbon and greenhouse gas problem.
Right.
So that's paramount. Without that, nothing else matters. The future of humanity is effectively, as we know it, the future of humanity is doomed if we do not solve this problem. Second one is how do we feed and support a growing population on the planet, particularly in light of the challenges that climate change is going to bring to our current agricultural and food system. And the third is, I guess, I don't know. I mean, I think the third is sort of how do we decide to live on this planet in ways that we can still have some sense of sort of personal satisfaction and enjoyment and recreational opportunities? How do we exist as individuals in the face of all of these overarching massive planetary scale challenges? And they all intertwine. Yeah, right, I think the ocean is a massive climate engine. There's no question. It is the source of half the oxygen we breathe. It has absorbed 90% of the heat that's been generated from excess emissions of carbon, blah, 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 statistics, on and on and on. The ocean is the regulator of our planet. It's why we have life on the planet in the first place.
Right.
It's because there's an ocean. It's because there's water. It is the primary source of protein for already over 3.5 billion people on this planet, on a planet that's rapidly going towards, 9 and 10 billion people, assuming that, we manage to get that far.
Yeah.
With that population.
Yeah. Assuming we make it that far.
We have farmed out, we are maximizing the production of food from land, and it's going to start to decline because of our history of treating soil badly. Like, that's a problem that people don't talk enough about. The decline in soil quality is going to lead to decline in crop yields at a time when we need more, and we can technology our way out of some of that. But at some point, that's going to catch up with us. We've got to figure out how we can leverage the 70% of space on the planet that is not occupied by humans. It's a massive amount of space, and it's an incredible resource at the same time. So figuring out how to produce more high-quality, delicious, low-carbon, healthy protein from the ocean will be critical. And we have ways to do that now, whether it's finfish or shellfish or seaweed. That needs to be a piece of the equation going forward. And we've got to protect the places that we love and that give us spiritual fulfillment. I grew up on Cape Cod. I live in South Portland. After I finish recording this with you, I'm going to go to the beach and jump in the ocean because it's 85 degrees and I'm hot. And I can do that. And it's a quality of life issue. I want to make sure that that still exists for my kid and for everybody else's kids and for these future generations.
Yeah.
We have spent too much of our recent history extracting And we've got to figure out how to get away from that mentality.
Very well said, Mike. Okay. Last question. I like to ask this of everyone. Do you have a favorite tale of the sea? Book, poem, song, story?
Probably the first one that grabbed me was Hemingway's Old Man and the Sea.
Right.
I love that one. And I've studied that. I've taught it. It's an incredible story. Classic, obviously. The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald is an incredible song.
Yeah,
like, might
incredible.
Be the most powerful emotional song that I know of. There's actually an amazing version of it by this band called Punch Brothers, which is sort of a classic bluegrass mandolin-led band. You know, Moby Dick. I've actually read it twice, all the way through all of the words, especially the parts about the whaling. You know, it's just amazing. That was the Literature of the Sea course at Mystic Seaport. You know, when I was studying there, Mystic Seaport is the home to the last remaining wooden sailing vessel in the world, the Charles W. Morgan.
Right.
And, you know, we lived at the seaport in houses right adjacent to it and, you know, had staff badges and kind of had the run of the place. And so we used to go down, you know, after the museum closed, a couple of us would take our books and go down to the Morgan and, like, sit alone. Sometimes I did it by myself on the deck of the whale ship, down below in the hold with a flashlight, you know, reading Moby Dick. And it was just one of the coolest experiences I've ever had. So
reading Moby Dick on a whaling ship, that doesn't get a lot better than that. I don't think so. Yeah. Mike, thank you. It's time for your swim and lunch down at the beach. Thank you so much. It's been great, very enjoyable and eye-opening for me. And I know for the folks who will listen in. But thank you so much for your time.
Absolutely. Thanks, Mark. It's been a pleasure.
That ends this episode of Tales of the Sea. My thanks to Michael Conathan for giving us his insight on the importance of the blue economy, as well as an insider's look at some of the things that go into making policy to protect what I consider to be our planet's most important feature for the future survival of our species, the sea. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to tell a friend or two. And remember, you can find Tales of the Sea wherever you stream your favorite podcasts.
Superior, they said, never gives up her dead when the gales of November come early.
I'm Mark Wankworth. Thanks for listening.